Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, this is Paul Gleason with Psychiatric Times. Our guest today is Dr. Anita H. Clayton. She's the David C. Wilson Professor and Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia, with a secondary appointment as Professor of Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology. She's the author of Satisfaction, Women, Sex, and the Quest for Intimacy, published by Ballantine Books in 2007, and an editor of the 2005 Women's Mental Health Comprehensive Textbook. She's also a program co-chair of the annual Psychiatric Times World CME Conference. Dr. Clayton, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm excited to be here.
Great. Now, May is Maternal Mental Health Month. And of course, the big issue this year has been the pandemic. Mothers bearing the brunt of taking care of kids, the house, and their careers. What are you seeing and hearing about the mental health impact on women, especially mothers? And have these problems reached clinical diagnosis levels?
Yes, so there have been some surveys done looking at what kinds of mental health symptoms we might be seeing related to the pandemic. And anxiety symptoms are increased and are being endorsed by 50% of people surveyed, much higher among women than men. And depressive symptoms are endorsed by 44% of individuals surveyed. We're also seeing increases in substance use disorders, particularly opioids, benzodiazepines, stimulants, and cannabis, which is being offered to women as a remedy for morning sickness or nausea.
You mentioned that there was a sort of gender gap there. Do we have a sense of why that is?
Well, there's probably two reasons. Women are twice as likely as men to experience a depressive episode. Anxiety disorders are not all that different, but slightly different. And then all the reproductive related kinds of symptoms that we can see are things like depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms. And so those are going to be increased in women too, because they're having these reproductive fluctuations in hormones.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been a lot of media attention and a few studies looking at the effects of the pandemic mitigation strategies, things like quarantine and distancing, and the effects those are having on children. I mean, I haven't seen as many studies on the effects of these strategies on mothers. Is that the case? And if so, sort of why?
So there is a significant impact of the pandemic on things like pregnancy. Women are fearful of becoming pregnant, exposing their children to COVID should they themselves become infected. I think that there are other factors playing a role too, in that younger people, which are reproductive age people, including women, seem more likely to be impacted by some of the losses that have occurred related to this. So not just illnesses and deaths in people that we know, but also things like not going to work or working remotely or taking school remotely or graduating and not being able to find a job or a job in a field we like. Sort of putting your life on hold in some ways, and especially when it comes to relationships. So some people stayed with people they wouldn't have stayed with because of the pandemic, and other people who weren't with people are having trouble finding people. So I do think that there's a lot of impact that maybe doesn't get talked about so much, but this was a collective trauma and people have been traumatized, and that contributes also to mental health issues.
So do you think that's going to have some long-term effects on sort of the nation's mental health?
I don't see how it cannot.
Yeah. And when we talk about maternal mental health, we often think of things like postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. What's sort of new or interesting in this field right now?
Well, I don't want to leave postpartum psychosis without speaking strongly about it, because that is a psychiatric emergency. It tends to have onset at about day three, right when the sex hormones have dropped and are back to normal levels, but a really steep slope to the line is happening there. And women who are sensitive, that may kick them into psychosis. That might be mania. It might be depression with psychosis. Or if they have a psychotic illness, we might see, reemergence of those symptoms at that point too. The problem there is that that's right when women have just gone home from the hospital. And so people may not be monitoring them that closely, or they may just look sort of organic that people might think is related to exhaustion from the delivery, from the baby not sleeping, or whatever. The problem is that it really is a psychiatric emergency. Harm to the mother and baby can occur in that setting relatively early on. And I think it's really important that we talk with mothers before they leave the hospital, so OBGYN, and also that pediatricians are looking at moms at the well baby check, which is again at the end of the first week after delivery. And those types of providers may in fact identify a difficulty and make a referral to psychiatry quickly.
So before we move on to the OBGYNs, you mentioned that, postpartum psychosis can be kind of hard to recognize. Are there other commonly overlooked issues, or what sort of challenges are there to diagnosing and treating these?
So I think if a woman had depression during pregnancy, then often that markedly increases the depressive symptoms she may experience postpartum. And I think a lot of times that has been somewhat overlooked. And so we might be saying, oh, well, we have some time, 4 weeks after delivery or whatever. But in truth, those women already were depressed, and then that's worsened or become more prominent after delivery too. So I think that that's one thing we should be thinking about. I think there are also some significant anxiety disorders that come on early in the postpartum period. So obsessive compulsive disorder can come on in that first couple of weeks and persist out for another couple of weeks and then develop into a postpartum depression. So we really should be looking for very obsessional behaviors on the parts of moms, or compulsions to do things, germaphobe kinds of behaviors or something else that indicates a difficulty there. We should also be looking for substance use disorders because in particular, if a mom gets a C-section, she may get opioids, and that may develop into a problem subsequent to delivery. And if she had an opioid addiction, I hope we would have identified that prior to delivery in order to spare the baby neonatal abstinence syndrome or withdrawal, which can have severe long-term consequences. So I think there's a lot of things going on then that may in fact be overlooked, that may be hidden by the family, that we need to be staying on top of or be quick to respond to if it looks like there's any evidence of that. And screening tools really help. The Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Rating Scale helps, the GAD-7 helps, and a more detailed psychiatric interview may be important too.
Right. And I'm sure your colleagues are familiar with some treatment options for all of these, but are there overlooked treatment options that you think don't get enough attention, which may be very helpful for some of these conditions?
So in the last couple of years, brexanolone, which is an allopregnanolone analog, which is a metabolite of progesterone, has been approved as a rapidly acting infusion for postpartum depression. So you give it over 60 hours and then watch the woman for another 12 hours. It requires inpatient monitoring for oxygenation because it can be pretty sedating. But you see a rapid response, and it's sustained out to 30 days. It may be sustained beyond that, but I think in my experience, I'm rather conservative about treating postpartum depression. I treat it for longer. I think it often isn't gone in a year. And even with treatment, so the episode hasn't ended. So if we were to discontinue the medication at that point, we just see a relapse or reemergence of symptoms. And so it's important for us to maintain that effectiveness. But this is really exciting. You can get a woman in remission in hours. So within the first day, within 24 hours. I think that's exciting. I think it's also important if a woman is depressed during pregnancy or we're fearful of a postpartum depression, we should be thinking about restarting her medicines that worked before at delivery. And I tend to make a joke with women and just say, so when that baby pops out, you're going to pop that pill in. And we know the dose that worked for them, so we can get them on that very quickly. And we've got a couple of weeks before we really see a lot of these symptoms, unless they were depressed during pregnancy, when I hope we would have already been treating them. Chronotherapy might be effective too, which a lot of times people don't think about. Daily bright light therapy can really be effective and doesn't kick people into mania. And I think if a woman has bipolar illness, we should be thinking about reestablishing her mood stabilizers or adding back ones that we might have reduced or eliminated in favor of something else during the pregnancy because of exposure. We even use ECT during pregnancy and postpartum because it also works quickly, because one of the things we really want to do is get her well quickly. You don't want to see these symptoms going on and on for a year or 2 years or 3 years. It becomes much more difficult to get her to remission and to help her be able to care for her family.
And turning now from the mother to the whole care team, you mentioned the importance of OBGYNs and nurses, and I'm sure primary care specialists come into it too. Do you see or hear much about collaboration? And what are some of the challenges of collaborating, and how can psychiatrists overcome them?
Yeah, so collaboration, or now even integrated care, is really pretty important. I think a lot of that may have to do with making a plan at the very beginning of pregnancy, whereby we, you know what we're going to do in terms of if she's been on meds before, if she's not been on meds before, but a family member has something, whatever. We're going to have a plan for what she wants to happen. We're going to set up her support team. Is that her partner? Is that her parents? Is that friends? Who is that? We need to be sure that there aren't things like food insecurity or housing instability, because those all contribute. And so social work may need to be involved in those circumstances, or nursing related to some of their care, and frequent visits and plans for what to do if she misses her prenatal visits or postpartum visits, both. Because both could be suggestive. One, maybe just she's got transportation problems, or two, it may be that psychiatric symptoms are developing. Screening, continuing to screen, always screening. I mean, I just can't say this enough, so that we can try to use quantitative variables to decide when we should treat and to look at response to treatment. And we need to effectively treat to remission. That's the other thing. I think sometimes we neglect that. Our moms are like, well, I don't want to take higher doses because I'm breastfeeding. No, remission is critical. Treating in a breastfeeding mom is not a problem. We can manage that. And effectively treating her to remission is critical.
Right. Now, how does motherhood affect pre-existing psychiatric disorders?
You know, when I was first going into psychiatry, I was planning to go into psychiatry. I thought I might do child psychiatry. And I went to the court and looked at what was going on with moms who were neglectful, more than abusive, neglectful. Unfortunately, the system does not intervene quickly. You can see significant impairments in kids out before the 5 years or so, maybe 3 years that they remove the baby from the home or the child at that point, or that they have some other kind of educational training, whatever. And I think that is really important because it becomes multi-generational when this happens. Plus, those children are probably at increased risk anyway because of the genetic material that they share. So I think that there are a lot of problems that impact on the children, on the family, the partner if the partner's in the picture, because if a partner's not in the picture, that markedly increases the problems and burden on the mom. And then, as I said, outside of that, family that's extended, her work, other social interactions in the community, things like that, that may or may not be able to be maintained if she's symptomatic and untreated.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you how you first got interested in the field, and I think you've sort of answered the question. It was going to court and seeing what a big problem this was and thinking, well, if only I could get there first. If only I were able to treat this before it got to a courtroom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then
you start to see the other, you know, that this is a special group of women that may be more sensitive to reproductive changes. We may be able to identify those women earlier if they have premenstrual dysphoric disorder before they have a pregnancy. And we really might be able to intervene early. And that seems pretty critical. We know even intervening in adolescents for anxiety disorders reduces their risk and severity should they go on to develop depressive symptoms. So early intervention is just really critical.
And, you know, you kind of entered the field in the 80s, and I was kind of wondering, you know, how has it changed? And what are some issues that you think psychiatry as a field still hasn't addressed enough yet?
Yeah, I think when I started, there was no such thing as premenstrual dysphoric disorder. There was an appendix that came out very soon after that called late luteal phase dysphoric disorder. There was a lot of debate about whether this was pejorative to women until we found out that 3-5% of women have this kind of difficulty that causes them to be dysfunctional. They're suffering, they're fearful. Their children are suffering, their partners are suffering, and treatment can potentially be effective. So I think that made a difference. And I think also looking at the menopause, it used to be thought of as strictly a single time point, when in fact, it's really a time frame of years that we need to be thinking about where hormonal changes are occurring that may or may not reach a point at which that sensitivity is then manifested as symptoms. So I really feel like a lot has happened in diagnoses related to women. And now we're starting to see changes in treatments, like with brexanolone. And then I think we're seeing changes in predictive risk markers and things like that, which would allow us to, again, intervene early.
Yeah, it sounds like the field is sort of expanding and expanding its understanding of what maternal mental health means and the time frames, you know, covering reproduction, not just pregnancy, but reproductive events of all kinds.
Exactly.
And you mentioned a couple of treatments that you're sort of excited about, fast-acting antidepressants and things like that. Are there other treatments that you have on your radar as well?
There were also studies done in women postpartum up to, they had to be within 6 months of their delivery with zuranolone, which is an oral positive allosteric modulator for GABA-A receptors. Similar to brexanolone, only it's an oral medication. It was effective when given at night for 14 nights. Again, quick response and sustained response. So I'm excited about that. I think more data about chronotherapy is important because a lot of women don't want to take a medicine. They would rather have some other intervention. I think we only really go to ECT when other things have failed or when something really dramatic has happened that requires an immediate intervention. It may be that transcranial magnetic stimulation will also be something that we find is effective for postpartum depression, although right now it's only approved for treatment-resistant depression. So I think other options, and then the medications are advancing so that adverse effects are less, even in our daily antidepressants. So we're even advancing in medications that might be taken daily or in some other way, or adjunctive treatments as well.
Right, and this leads into my next questions about kind of your hopes for the future. What do you expect that maternal mental health will look like in 10 or 20 years?
Wow, if I could look at what might be ideal, it would be that we ensure that women have adequate supports, resources, et cetera, before she becomes pregnant. She has an opportunity to spend time with her baby after delivery, although we're seeing more of this happening now, before she returns to the workforce, if that's what she wants to do. Identifying conditions early, looking at biomarkers or some other kinds of indicators of increased risk in women, and enhancing preventative care, interventions that just help her stay well, because I think we're working toward wellness and well-being as opposed to just treating illness and infirmity.
Yeah, it sounds like the hope is to expand from, you know, treatments associated with pregnancy and birth to reproductive health as a kind of a whole lifetime issue. That would be, here's hoping. And then if that's the big ideal picture, let's end on something small. You know, if you could share one important clinical tip or piece of advice with your colleagues, you know, what would that be?
Screen early and often.
Screen early and screen often. Thank you again, Dr. Clayton. Thank you so much for coming on Psychiatric Pearls.
Thank you for having me and talking about this important topic.